across 110th Street. Pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street. Pushers won't let the junkie go free. Hey, it's Aaron and Jim back with another commission podcast, this time for the movie Jackie Brown, a Quentin Tarantino film that I had not seen up until this moment of commissioning. Special thanks, as always, goes out to the Community Commission. This was multiple bald movers pooling their money together to do a commission podcast, including Steven Sprague, Spencer H., Libby Ross, Dr. Edible, Cellmouse, Brooks Rittle, Betamaric, Coco, 2MC, No Brains, All Sadness, Martin Carlson, Eric Brown, RJ Joan 2, and Keith A. And they have a bit of a feedback to go along with it. This movie, of course, was the screenplay written by Quentin Tarantino. It's based on a book called Rum Punch by Elmore Leonard. And of course, directed by Quentin Tarantino. I'm going to let Libby Ross kind of introduce us here. It says Jackie Brown is one of my top five favorite movies ever. A classic that never gets dated because it's an Elmore Leonard story. One that Elmore has had a director who arguably does his best work ever. Quentin Tarantino, a script that celebrates Leonard's language and plotting, an amazing, amazing cast with perfect chemistry. Not a single dud in the bunch. Icing on the cake is the electric pairing of Everyman's man, Robert Forster, with the magnificent Pam Grier. Perfection. What did you think of this film?
I actually think this might be my second favorite Tarantino film.
Oh, shit. I thought you were going to say least favorite.
No.
It's going to be an awkward podcast.
No, it was great. It's better than Reservoir Dogs. It's much more polished, much more refined style, stylistically and visually even. I think it's great. And I had never seen it before, so first viewing.
I agree, and I think that there is it's probably going to be something that improves with subsequent watches. But I really like it, too. It's one of the least Tarantino-feeling movies I've ever seen, and that probably has a lot with him adapting Elmore Leonard's novel rather than him just starting from a blank canvas.
Yeah.
It also seems like it's the most conventional. The hallmarks of a Quentin Tarantino film are like sparkling, over the top, machine gun fired dialogue, which I do feel like this movie has.
Oh yeah,
but I also feel like that's an Elmore Leonard thing too.
Mm-hmm.
If the works I'm familiar with is the Raylan Givens stuff from Justified, Get Shorty, And they kind of have the same thing. The other hallmarks are like over-the-top violence, which was extremely restrained in this movie. In fact, most of the deaths, except for, I guess, Robert De Niro's, happen entirely off-screen.
Yeah,
implied violence.
In regards to like showing the violence, I think you're right. The implied violence is there in spades.
Certainly.
And it is brutal and intense.
But it's not like some dude getting his head splattered over Jules' rear, window. That's what I'm talking about. Like, it's not the final act of Inglourious Bastards. It's nothing like that. And in fact, it feels like maybe... Do you think Quentin Tarantino wanted to do a conventional kind of Hollywood film that's a little bit more restrained, a little bit more like show his like just raw filmmaking chops, and then he's like took 6 years off apparently and then came back with Kill Bill and never looked back?
Yeah, I don't know. Not sure why he made this. I have not had a chance to like hear any interviews. I'm sure he's given them about this movie.
The guy's really thoughtful about... Just, I think his legacy and what he's known for and his role of promoting violence and whatnot and cinema. And I kind of just see him as like, if I go from Pulp Fiction and just do the other movies I want to do without any kind of detour, like I might never be taken seriously. Like I'll be pigeonholed in some kind of genre bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that might limit what I'm able to do in the future. I don't know. This is all just me making shit up.
Right.
But I'm just trying to explain what attracted him to this role, because if he wanted to, I mean, obviously he really liked Pam Grier. He tried to get her into Pulp Fiction. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. No.
Um, I f- the Patricia Arquette character was supposed to be Pam Grier, and he says the reason he didn't cast her is like when the guy has to yell at her, I don't think anyone would buy this guy like yelling or intimidating at Pam Grier.
Yeah.
But if he wanted to do that, I'm sure he could come up with a, you know, just a completely unique Quentin Tarantino movie. The other thing I read constantly in kind of researching this film is everyone saying that this is his love letter to blaxploitation films.
Okay.
Which I felt was a really shallow and wrongheaded kind of note to say about this film. Because other than casting Pam Grier in it and some of the soundtrack choices, and of course, you know, he kind of leaned into the Foxy Brown stuff with the film's font and all. Like, that's just right. That's really superficial trappings where he, I guess, was paying homage to her career, but the rest of it doesn't play like blaxploitation at all.
Yeah, the bulk of the movie doesn't. Certainly, I see why people might think that. Maybe if you hadn't seen the movie, and I guess that's the impression that I had of it more going in, since I had never seen it before, and I knew that, you know, Pam Grier's career history.
Yeah.
And kind of the way she was perceived in Hollywood, I expected more of that, and I didn't really get it.
No, I was expecting more like Foxy Brown Coffee kind of, you know, female version of Shaft gangster film.
Yeah.
But it's really middle-aged black woman who's just trying to get by in life, getting pinched in circumstances of not making enough money and, you know, doing some hauling cash around to make ends meet, and she gets pinched by the cops and she's stuck between this gangster and I thought it was great. I also
it was
really
a much more straightforward kind of heist movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I mean it's a straight up crime drama. And fairly believable. And the other thing that's, I guess, a hallmark of Elmore Leonard is people, I mean, like reasonably highly intelligent people, but also not glory. Like, there's always, like, his criminal characters always have, like, fatal flaws.
Yeah.
Like, they're smart, but they're not as smart as they think they are. And also, you never forget that they're operating above and beyond the law. So if they make a mistake, it costs.
Yeah.
More than your average mistake does. And I thought that was
and oftentimes really good. The efforts they go to cover their mistakes they've made end up getting them in worse trouble, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, which is one of the things I like about, you know, Justified and this movie.
It's funny because Robert Forster has been on my mind lately. I was watching the reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000 on Netflix, and he's got a starring role in this movie called Avalanche, this disaster film from the late 70s, which is ridiculous. And I'm like, I've seen this guy a bunch. Of course, he's been in a lot of things. But most recently, he played the vacuum cleaner repair guy in Breaking Bad. I believe he was a sheriff or sheriff's deputy on a season of Fargo. And then I saw him here, and he's really, really good. And the chemistry between him and Pam Grier, it's like you – the way I really appreciated the way he sold the fact that he kind of fell in love with this Jackie at first sight.
Yeah, even though, you know, she comes out of jail that night, she's looking bad by her own admission. And despite all that, there's something about her that he can just sniff out, you know?
Yeah, there's something about the way she's walking or the way she's carrying herself or with the added intrigue of what's going on with the Odell stuff he knows about. And he's like, this is a person who is a cut above and is stuck in a shitty situation. And I like her.
I did think the first sight thing was kind of dumb. That's maybe the one part of the movie I didn't like because he can't even see her. A, she's in complete darkness. B, she looks like a train wreck, which she says. And he hasn't even talked to her yet. And all of a sudden, like, the music starts playing and he starts going, oh, this is the one. What?
It's the soundtrack. Fuck are you talking about? Gets you all the time.
Yeah. Where is the soundtrack coming from? Are they playing this on the PA system outside the jail?
Jim Jones, soul of a poet. And that's the thing, like, every single time, because the movie relies, I guess, on that relationship. I mean, I don't think she can pull this off without that kind of falling into her lap. And,
and they definitely sold it later on. It was just literally the first sight thing.
And also, like, every step, like, every time he was, like, considering whether he should get in deeper, like, you could see him kind of thinking, like, yeah, sure, okay. What I got to lose? I hate my job. I hate my... And also, how he pulls back at the end. because I think he's honestly kind of surprised slash impressed at how really ruthless she is.
Yeah.
And then there's the double twist at the end where it's like he's kind of already regretting the decision as soon as she walks out of the door. It's like that one thing. It's like if you're torn between two decisions, then mentally commit to one of them and then judge your reaction. And if your reaction is, oh shit, I've made a mistake, then you've made a mistake. Flip back the other word. And I feel like as soon as she gets in the BMW and takes off, he's like, God damn it, I should have gone to Spain. Yeah. Maybe it's not too late. I can meet her at the airport.
Do you know how old Quentin Tarantino was when he made this movie?
Late 30s?
Do you know how old Elmore Leonard was when he wrote it?
Like, no, I have no idea.
Okay.
Because Elmore Leonard...
I don't either, but it's clear to me that this is a midlife crisis movie, right?
Mm.
I mean, we're talking about people who are in their 40s and 50s.
Right.
You know, Max is definitely beyond his midlife at this point.
Right.
Pam Grier is in the midst of it, and she's trying to get to a position where she doesn't have to start over again.
So, Elmer, he was in, I think, his early 50s when he wrote this novel with some quick mental math I'm doing. So
that would probably make sense.
Which might make Robert Forster like a Mary Sue type character.
Yeah.
That's Elmore Leonard saying, yeah, this is what I'd do if Jackie Brown walked into, which, you know, in the Rum Punch, the protagonist is a white woman.
Right. Yeah, they switched it.
Yeah, he switched it. And Elmore Leonard because I guess Quentin Tarantino was so intimidated by Elmore Leonard that he didn't tell him about any of the changes to the film until his novel until they were about to shoot. And he's like, God, I got to do it.
Yeah.
So he hands, and I guess Elmore Leonard just loved it. He says, of course, he's dead now, so he doesn't say anything, but he said it's the best screenplay of any of the novel, and his things have been adapted to film.
They have.
Now, since then, I wonder, because it seems like he had a real special fondness for Justified as well.
Yeah.
But you know, up until that, you know, the cinematic crown was going to Quentin Tarantino and Jackie Brown.
Yeah, and Tarantino, make no mistake, put his stamp on this movie from the dialogue to even the setting. Like, he took it originally from Miami in the book to L.A. in the movie. So, you know, Tarantino is almost synonymous with L.A. crime movies at this point.
Right.
So he's definitely got his fingers all over it. And I don't know. I think that it – I wonder if that's why people – we're also wondering about, you know, the blaxploitation angle of it is because it was not originally supposed to be a black woman in the role.
Huh.
And Tarantino did that. And Tarantino, you know, he likes those kind of movies, right?
Right.
I mean, he's a student of that genre. So you can kind of expect that to come out of him. But
yeah, I definitely think he...
I don't feel like it was over the top here.
No, I mean, I definitely think he wanted to play homage to that because it certainly... fits it, but you know, Django Unchained is much more clearly a blaxploitation type of film.
Yeah,
you know, and he kind of got that out of his system. But I don't think Quentin Tarantino is the type of guy who casting Pam Grier in a starring role in something like this could not play with the logo and the soundtrack a little bit,
right?
Like, he just, you know, in principle, if you tempt Quentin Tarantino, he's going to fall for the temptation. So I'm kind of impressed that it's as straightforward as it is. And you know, you've also got Sam Jackson,
right?
He's certainly a larger than life character that could be his Odell Roby could certainly be at home in a Shaft movie,
yeah,
or, you know, any of those 70s style blaxploitation films, but you know, he's inhabiting. He's also opposite Robert De Niro, which really interesting role for him because he's like kind of passive and dumb. I saw a lot of things said about him being dumb, and I don't know that that's the greatest read on the situation because he's also smart enough to see that he's being manipulated by the Bridget Fonda's character.
Melanie.
I don't have a handle on all these guys' characters yet. And he goes and he tells... It's like one of those guys who he's smart enough to tell the boss about a potential problem with his operation, not smart enough to turn down free sex when he thinks it's the boss's girlfriend.
Right.
And
not even as smart as, what's his name from Pulp Fiction?
Oh, Vincent.
Vincent. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Not even that smart.
Nope. And Vincent wasn't the brightest bulb.
No, he wasn't.
In the I don't know, lampshade. What is that? Isn't that the brightest bulb in the...
In the bunch?
That makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Brightest bulb in the fixture? Like, brightest bulb in the box? Well, no, there's no bright bulbs in boxes. They're fucking not plugged in anything. But yeah, there's something interesting then, because they imply that he knew her when he was young, that she was younger, or maybe he was looking at all these pictures of her when she was younger, mm-hmm. which is, you know, they kind of portray as slightly creepy that, you know.
And they say he knew her like 6 years ago was the last time they saw each other.
Right. So, yeah. Because she's been with, they implied that she's been with Odell for a long, long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course they have sex and they have this weird kind of relationship, and then he's so frustrated with her that he ends up shooting her, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what to make of that, because that seemed like kind of out of character for his character.
I don't know. I mean, this is a guy who is dumb enough to think he can get away with robbing a bank, and he's impulsive enough to actually do it.
Okay.
I certainly expected him to, like, backhand her or something.
Oh, yeah. No.
I did not expect him to blow her away.
Sure. Yeah.
That surprised even me. And I, in a good way, not in a bad way. It was.
And I like how matter of fact it was.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that was just, holy shit, this major character in the film has just been blown away. And she's just going to be left in the parking lot. And I'm like, how are the cops not going to find her? Well, of course the cops find her.
It felt to me like what a dangerous and not super intelligent person mm-hmm. might do in the heat of the moment.
Now,
they just get flustered and make a bad decision.
I want to take a dovetail from the praise we've heaped on the film so far and talk about some problems I had with it, because I think there's some critical flaws or maybe holes in the plot, which may fill in after I've seen it a few times or if I mm-hmm. read the book, but it seems like if the cops have a close eye on both Jackie and Odell, as they claim they do, mm-hmm. that there's no way they would be fooled. Yep. In fact, it almost seemed like Jackie needed to have Robert De Niro's character, Lewis, blow Melanie away and then get shot himself to sell the idea that some kind of treachery was going on, because otherwise Michael Keaton's
like an Italian Job style thing, right?
Yeah, it seemed like without that she'd have been fucked, and maybe that's something Elmore's playing with, the fact that like she's smart too but not that smart,
right?
And she needed some help, some outside help beyond her control for it to go down the way, because if everything had gone the way it's supposed to go, mm-hmm. The cops, number one, how in the hell can she slip and do all this stuff in the dressing room? That seems suspicious as hell. How can Odell go to a strip club and get away without being detected? In fact, how the hell can he, like the cops have been watching him since before the movie started. How does he just go pick up the guy he just bailed out of jail and blow him away?
Uh-huh.
Like, behind the hotel that he's living in. Like, that shit doesn't make sense from what I think I understand about the movie. And it seems very, like... Now, it could be the cops are just lying or, like, overstating how much heat is on Odell. But that none of that is evidence in the movie. And it was distracting me, because the whole third act I'm trying to figure out, like, how is she going to eventually fool the cops? And how is she going to sell this scheme? And it turns out she needs a massive assist from Louis and Odell overreacting to things to make that go the way she needed it to go. Do you think I'm right? Does it not bother you as much? Or do you have any answers for me?
This is interesting. So why do you think the cops were there at the end of the movie to blow away? Like, why was Ray able to shoot Odell?
I definitely think that that's...
What did she tell the cops to get them there?
Well, because last time Michael Keaton's character is Ray. I'm surmising you just mentioned his name, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Ray, because he kind of suspects that Jackie is up to something too, and I like the scenes of like Ray and Odell, like they spend like a good 60 seconds just watching Samuel Jackson turn the wheels over in his mind in that van before he finally like opens his eyes as like Jackie Brown. Uh-huh. And I feel like that Ray was doing the same thing in his interrogation with her. Like, I can't prove anything's weird going on, but this is how I see it, and you better hope that we find Odell before her. So I think she collaborated with him to kind of set Odell up. And then...
Right. Did she tell him about the money? Because the entire movie she's saying, this guy doesn't care about the money. He just wants to get Odell.
Right, and the other thing is that she's been consistently telling them about that this second drop is going to be $50,000, not $500,000. So they're looking for the $50,000 that they find, not the whole $500,000.
Right.
So I think that from his perspective, she just, you know, again, this happens off screen, we have to surmise it, but she calls Ray and says, this guy's going, I've told him that, you know, he's got, oh, but yeah, why would she be tracking him down?
So I don't know that they even believe her.
Yeah.
And I think they're not going to give her the immunity that she wants until they actually get Odell. And so she's forced to bring Odell back in by telling Odell about the $450 that she's got.
Right.
But not telling the cops about that, telling them about the $50.
Well, that's the other thing is that Melanie skimmed some off the top, those marked bills for herself.
Which helped her again.
And I think that she kind of knew that would happen.
Yeah. Because she said, hey, this is cherry on top for you.
Right.
And the implication.
What has he ever done for us? So I think that she counted on that to happen, and then maybe the police would find them because they're tailing them. But if they're tailing them as close, it's not making sense. I think... what she sold them on is that maybe Odell had smoked out that the cops were onto him and that he was going to try to rub her out. So, because she couldn't tell the cops about the $500,000 or else she wouldn't have to be able to make
But she could reclaim the $50 and get Odell in the process, right? By luring him back with the $450 that the cops don't know about.
But that's what I'm saying. What story would she tell the cops?
I can get him back. He's got... Oh,
right.
Why would Odell come back?
I have $500,000 of his money. I know he's going to be coming. Like,
well, I mean, she could tell him anything. Like, I can get Odell back, and maybe they give her one last opportunity. Because I don't think the cops buy it. Like,
no, I get it.
The cops don't buy that she had nothing to do with this money disappearing.
But if the fact that it didn't go down the way it always went, it kind of leads credence to her story that, you know, they knew the fix was in, and some, you know, because criminals do, they have this sixth sense that, like, you know, they can feel the heat on them. We see this with The Wire, we see it in Justified, we see it a lot of different ways, and that, you know, like, that it's plausible that they just jumped the gun to, and there's nothing that Jackie did wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just weird that, like, I don't understand that last little bit of the third act.
Yeah.
So... But it's not, like I said, I don't think it's a fatal flaw.
No, and I think there's a lot of wiggle room to just say she told them something that made them think she could get Odell back there. And she did it in the end, you know.
Right.
She obviously didn't tell them about the $450 because they would have wanted that.
Right.
But I like how it's kind of a mix of intelligence, desperation, and luck that's going on in this movie, where you have a lot of people who have a lot of intelligence. Like, you look at Sam Jackson's character, Odell. He's a smart guy, right? His lines about knowing Melanie but not trusting her, and kind of understanding what person she is, and knowing that trusting that Melanie will always act like Melanie.
Mm-hmm. Remind me of Lil Wayne's line about Ho's going to be Ho, so you can't blame Tammy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Sounds about right. You know, Jackie is a very desperate person, and he trusts Jackie, but he doesn't know Jackie.
Right.
And that's what gets him fucked.
She's because a wild
he doesn't,
card.
He can't anticipate the moves that she's going to make because he only trusts her. He doesn't know her.
Right. Yeah, Melanie's a joker, but he knows she's a joker, whereas Jackie's the wild card, and he doesn't know.
Yeah. And she's desperate, you know? She's the wild card because things have changed.
Right.
She's got to get out.
Right. Do you... It also seems like that he would just try to kill her again. I understand that she intimidated him off the first and then said, hey, I got a way for you to get your $500,000 back and, you know, befuddle the cops. But he has to trust her to do that. Like, it seems like for the smart play would just be to go along with her and then kill, like, throw her off the balcony or kill her when she's over at Melanie's house or do whatever and then figure out a way to get his $500 back sometime else.
Right.
Send his, you know, country girl.
Yeah.
That thinks Compton's L.A. or Hollywood down there to get it.
Yeah, she's rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he just needed her too much because he didn't have another way to get that money.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. What do you think Ordell wants with that money? I know it's his money and he says it's retirement
money, right?
Is he planning to get out of the game?
Yeah, he's been hustling and grinding on this arm stuff, yeah. And then he's about to get out.
That makes total sense, given the, you know, the desperation of it all, the midlife crisis that this movie is.
Right, right.
He's done with this.
Right. And, you know, $500,000 of cash, if you're, like, you know, your late 40s or early 50s, could probably go a long way. If you have a, you know, lifestyle like Odell's, where you're just essentially moving from... apartment and house that other people own, and you don't really have a base of operations. And
yeah.
I'll keep him in Kangol hats for a long, long while.
I thought you were going to say moving from screwdriver to screwdriver, because holy shit, man.
Yeah.
He drinks a lot of vodka.
Yes, he does. Screwdrivers. That's his drink. He knows his drink, and that's what he's going to stick to.
Good for him. I like it. They do a great job of setting the tone early on. Like, uh-huh. You really feel like you're in all parts of the criminal justice system here, right?
Right.
Because they take you to court. They take you to the bail bondsman.
Oh, yeah. We got to see Tasha Yar.
Right. We do. And the guy from House of a Thousand Corpses, whose name I don't remember.
I didn't recognize him, but yeah.
Yeah. They do a real good job of setting the tone just with this first meeting with Max. Like, uh-huh. Here's this guy who...
Max Cherry. What a name.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a long time, and he's grizzled, and he doesn't take any shit, and you can tell it right off the bat. But then here's Sam Jackson, who looks like he doesn't belong in this place, right? Mm-hmm. But he is so adept at what he's doing and this side of the business, right? Mm-hmm. He's used to getting people off the hook. He's used to the bail bond scene. It really shows you kind of – it does a lot of character building right there from the very jump with Sam Jackson.
Right.
And I thought it was really good. And, you know, just the look of it, like the wood paneling, just the setting gets you in a mood.
Yeah, the location stuff was all really good. Like, you know, what'd you say Bridget Fonda's character was? Melanie?
Melanie, yeah.
Melanie. Melanie's like little beach bungalow and Shoshanda. Was it Shoshanda? Was the country girl? Like her shithole house in Compton was cool. Like the Max Cherry's office. Like, yeah, you're right. The location work here was really, really good.
It is. And
location
and costuming. You always can like almost taste the smoke in the air.
Uh-huh.
Like on all of these scenes,
you see people smoking. What was
and
that?
It's like,
what was the bar that was right by her house? That place was fucking awesome.
The one where it was like,
blood red
at night, red.
But then it's like, you know, like when Sam Jackson's there, he's like, damn, I'm going to have to remember this place.
That was a cool place.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah, the movie felt cool, which is a very Elmore Leonard / Quentin Tarantino thing.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino got to indulge his foot fetish again.
Oh, with the toes in the glass. Gross.
Yeah.
I wouldn't touch that glass after that happened.
Yeah, I think Bridget Fonda is super attractive, but they did a really great job with the spray tan and just her hair to make her look like she's just starting to go to seed. Like, you know.
Right.
Just starting to go to seed.
Yeah.
And also she's been, I don't think she's done anything but sit on that couch and smoke weed for about a decade.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, and the pieces she was using just kept getting more and more elaborate. I enjoyed that aspect of them, too.
Were there any characters in this movie that you absolutely despised?
No, but I think I know who you're going to say. Chris Tucker is your... I can't fucking stand Chris Tucker
in anything
he's
in.
You didn't like him in this?
I thought he was hilarious.
Him.
I hate him in everything he's in.
Wait, I know we've talked about this because I kind of think it's a commissioned podcast, but... You didn't like him as Ruby Rod in The Fifth Element?
No. God, no.
So, really?
I hate Ruby Rod. I hate the character. I hate him. I hate the man himself.
Did you like
everything about Chris Tucker annoys the I can't stand him.
You don't like him with Jackie Chan?
No.
No?
No, he's borderline tolerable.
Because I thought, like, he does... I thought he was great in this film because he's supposed to be a fuck-up.
Yeah.
He's a fuck-up.
I don't like his voice. I don't like anything about Chris Tucker.
Mm, all right. Well, that's fair.
I can't help it.
I mean, some people...
I have an irrational hatred of the man.
All right. I can...
What am I going to do?
I definitely can dig that. It's funny because I was when I was watching in the opening scenes, I was watching Robert De Niro sit next to Sam Jackson as he's just motor-mouthing about these guns. I'm like, what must it be like to just sit there in the same room as Sam Jackson where he's just dropping N-bomb after N-bomb and motherfucker this and motherfucker that. And like you're sitting there supposed to be like this right out of jail con that you got a relationship. Like what must that be like?
Yeah.
That this guy who's completely not like this guy is just inhabiting the same space and room. I thought it was fascinating.
You just let it wash over you, I think, which is kind of what he does.
Right.
In that scene.
And also... It's kind of funny because I guess who's the bigger star, Robert De Niro or Sam Jackson?
At that point in their careers?
I mean, I'm not even going to play that. I mean, at that point in their careers.
Yeah. Now I would argue Sam Jackson probably is, but
even now,
at that point,
think he's bigger than De Niro.
Robert De Niro, certainly.
Hmm.
I mean, that's around like Casino era, right?
Yeah, I guess
Casino-ish
it would be.
Casino-ish De Niro?
90, yes.
I think like 93 is Casino.
That's all in the mid-90s, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know, probably Robert De Niro.
Because I think at that point, like, that's still the peak, because, like, you know, I'm not sure when Heat was done, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, that's kind of arguably peak De Niro, because The Godfather's already behind him, Raging Bull's already behind him, Taxi Driver's already behind him.
Oh, totally peak
like,
De Niro, yeah.
What's he done since? Like, Meet the Fockers and Bullwinkle and...
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying he hasn't done anything. Like, he's doing the Bernie Madoff thing now with HBO that looks pretty cool.
Yeah, he did a boxing movie not too long ago.
Yeah,
he was
the
old coach.
Hands of Stone.
Yeah,
or Stone Hands.
I haven't seen it yet, but
me either.
I think it's
coming to HBO this month.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I would say it's Robert De Niro, especially at that point.
At that point, yes.
But Sam Jackson is just dominating him.
It's true, yeah.
And I'm not saying like he's acting his ass, he's out acting him. I'm just saying that like that was Robert De Niro must have had a hell of a lot of respect for Quentin Tarantino after like Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs and whatnot to go in and essentially take the back seat to Sam Jackson.
Yeah,
like I'm just going to be second fiddle. I'm going to do this thing and let Sam Jackson kind of shine and slap me around the screen because, yeah, that's not how I would think it would go down. Knowing kind of their relative points they were in their careers.
Yeah,
and that just shows Sam Jackson's a fucking star.
Yeah,
he's charismatic as hell.
Yeah, I mean, ever since, Die Hard 3, been Sam Jackson fan, so.
I'm trying to think, like, what the first thing I've seen, because it's either Die Hard 3 or, the legal film, like, A Time to Kill?
I don't know that I've seen
that. That's the classic, yes, I killed them, and I hope they burn in hell, Sam Jackson.
Huh, okay.
That was early 90s. But yeah, I'm not
I mean now he's in Star Wars and
he's in everything.
Just you know, a lot of Tarantino movies.
We need an excuse to do like one of these days. We're gonna get an excuse to do like a deep dive in his filmography and kind of decide like when he arrived.
I mean,
when
would that be? Because we've done Pulp Fiction, we've done Jackie Brown.
Fuck it,
and
fuck
we've
it.
Done
we're doing
Django.
It now. We're doing it live.
We've done Django. We
didn't prepare for this, but we're doing it live.
And we did first run of Tarantino's new movie, Hateful Eight. So when would that be that we'd have
opportunity? It's now, motherfucker. All right. So, man, I hate the way they do this thing, and it's fucking not reverse chronological order. You got to go way back here, man. His first role is in 1972. Together for Days, he played Stan. Let's just go to something I've actually heard. Coming to America, 1988. Eddie Murphy,
really?
He played a stick-up man.
Okay, so like a,
do
just
not,
a bit
he
part.
Did not stand out to there. Do the Right Thing. Okay, I should probably recognize him in that, but I don't. Let's see. Going Mo' Better Blues. Never saw that. No fucking way he's in Goodfellas?
When?
I've seen Goodfellas like 20 times, and I don't remember Sam Jackson being in it. Holy shit. Let's see. Keep on moving. Keep
extras?
Yeah, I don't know. He's in Patriot Games, which was that Tom Clancy, Harrison okay. Ford joint. I do yep. not remember him in there.
He's trying to stop the assassination of the president?
I think he, if I was guessing, he's probably playing, because one of the plots in that was the Irish gangsters teaming up with, like, black nationalists. So mm-hmm. he's probably playing one of the, you know, when they're teaming up to do an operation on American soil. But I don't remember that. He was in Menace to Society, Jurassic Park, 93.
Right. He's the computer guy. One Jurassic of the computer Park, guys. 93. Hold on to your butts.
Yep.
He's that guy.
And, oh, he was in True Romance, which is another Quentin Tarantino. Like, I don't think he directed it. He wrote it. But then you get Pulp Fiction.
And then he just broke out from there.
And that's like, he's that kind of cemented who he was. Then he was in Die Hard. Then he was in A Time to Kill. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's, I guess, I mean, he just went from sometime between Jurassic Park and Pulp Fiction. He just decided he was going to be Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
And that's what he did.
I got to say, I like the Sam Jackson that we have now much more than the Sam Jackson that could have been, like the guy just sitting in the background playing on computers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, he was so boring in Jurassic Park. There was nothing standout about
That's
him.
That's not fair.
Aside from the line, hold on to your butts,
hold
nobody
on
even
butt.
Remembers
no one
him.
Works, no one works a cigarette dangling off their lip like Sam Jackson in fucking Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I'm just saying, he had nothing that interesting to do. I'm glad we got Sam Jackson as a breakout star.
Right, right.
In
yeah.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of... Like, what's the... I'm going to throw out an un-Sam Jackson performance... Unbreakable.
Okay, yeah, totally.
Is Elijah Price, which I hear that they're working on.
Yeah, he plays the villain.
Yeah, M. Night Shyamalan is working on a sequel to that.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
They're going to let him make it?
Yeah.
Did Unbreakable do well?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much money it made because I wasn't paying attention, but that's a badass movie. And
Bruce Willis and Sam Jackson reprising their roles from Die Hard 3.
Yeah.
Just 10 years down the line.
Yeah. Mr. Glass is even more brittle. What's going to happen? But yeah, I mean, I guess the Star Wars stuff is not very Sam Jackson either, but nobody was very their essence in that. All right. There we go. Yeah, I'm looking at all the roles he's done, and he's kind of just Sam Jackson in every one of these things. Mm-hmm. Black Snake Moan, did you see that?
I didn't.
I mean, it's still pretty Sam Jackson, but it's a bit different, a bit edgier. He's a little...
I thought he did a really great job in Django Unchained.
Oh, yeah.
He was not very Sam Jackson in that.
That's...
He was a different... He had a different gear.
Okay.
That was still fierce and, like, intimidating, but... I mean, obviously
right,
subservient,
exactly.
For the bulk of that movie.
Right, literally.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we did an abbreviated IMDb dive of him. Because, like, okay. I was wondering, like, maybe there's just, like, this vast iceberg of his career that I could delve. But I don't think there is. Like,
no.
Yeah,
not
looks
a
like
ton.
It's a lot of minor roles and extra type of stuff.
Let me ask you this. If you're a gangster.
Okay.
An arms dealer.
Uh-huh.
And you routinely kill people less than a mile from your house and in broad daylight.
Uh-huh.
Do you really want to have a long-ass soul patch and a gigantic ponytail and a Kangol beret or whatever the hell those golf hats are? I don't know.
Yeah, and then, like,
and
Sam
a
Jackson
bright
just
ass
wears
yellow
those
coat.
Now. Yeah.
Like...
He's colorful, literally.
Okay, ma'am, could you tell us what you saw outside your window? Yeah, I saw a black guy in a yellow coat
with
a massive
soul patch,
ponytail.
Except for it's like a rat tail soul patch.
Right.
And he's got a big ass ponytail. He's got this kangaroo hat on.
How could he have not
been caught
by now?
He's got like
a
Curious George yellow jacket on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it seems to me like you would want to be more of a Gustavo Fring, right?
Maybe that's
like,
because I'm
hiding
other thing,
in plain sight.
I'm thinking like an arms dealer that's amassed $500,000 over his career. Like the ATF is sweating this guy, but maybe this is just, he's the low hanging fruit.
Yeah,
like you know, we could go after guys making
this
you know,
is
we
filling
could,
their quota.
We could go after Nick Cage and Lord of War, but
right.
Let's go after the guy in the bright yellow jacket who's dropping bodies like all the time.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing I wrote in my notes is, like, Sam's dropping a lot of bodies. This is late-stage criminal I'm watching.
Yep.
That's the equivalent of the cop saying I'm 2 weeks away from retirement.
Right.
Like, when you start dropping this many bodies, like, that's, you know.
Forced retirement.
Yeah, yeah. Are marked bills really this stupid?
Just a marker on the zero?
Yeah, I thought marked bills meant, like, they kept track of the serial range, or, like, yeah. I didn't think it was literally, like, Birdman getting a fucking Sharpie out and dotting the same spot in every stack of the bill.
Uh-huh.
Like, that, I was really, really disappointed if that's in actuality what marked bills means.
Yeah.
That was, like, really lo-fi.
It is.
Like, if I'm a criminal and I'm, like, doing a big deal and I see a giant Sharpie dot on every one of the bills, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
And I kill the guy.
Right.
I kill the guy and I leave the money.
Yeah.
Because that's bullshit bait that they're trying to feed me.
But maybe it's, yeah, I mean, maybe they have a myriad ways of marking them. Like, sometimes it's a red pin and it's on the nose of Benjamin Franklin. They paint him like a clown.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it would seem pretty
conspicuous.
Yeah, they put
Groucho Marx glasses on Abraham Lincoln. Uh-huh. That's how you know. That's how you know.
They Spock him. They Spock the bill.
Yes, if you're a gangster, you got to specify, I need to be paid in unspocked bills.
Right. Otherwise, it's just all Spocks.
Non-sequential, a small denomination, unspocked bills. Or the deal's off.
Yep. There were a couple of shots that I really liked. I kind of liked when they go split screen to show you something that's happening previously, something that's going to be important in the scene coming up.
Yeah.
And that you have no knowledge of prior to this. They want to give you that knowledge economically, because this is a 2.5 hour movie. It's
yes.
not a short movie. So I think they took those opportunities to kind of shorten it a little bit while still giving you all the info you needed.
I agree with that. What did you think about the three separate POVs? Like, we got to see the last 15 minutes of the movie three different times, and I found that on the third time through kind of tedious. Like, I don't know. I think a little bit better of an editing job could have blended those together seamlessly, and it would have added a lot more tension. There'd have been a lot more aha moments, and it would have shortened the movie a good 15, 20 minutes, which I don't think would be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't bored.
Yeah, you could be right.
I mean, this movie's pace was a lot statelier and a lot more patient than your average Tarantino. Because Tarantino mm-hmm. makes long-ass films.
Yeah.
With the exception of Hateful Eight, they don't feel long. Hateful
right.
Eight, I mean, you know, we did a remote view to movie.
Yeah.
Not my favorite Quentin Tarantino film. But I don't know, because I saw a lot of people praising those separate POV endings. I don't know.
Yeah. Not sure how I feel about those.
And that's the most minor of criticisms. I'm just saying, I was just thinking, like, it would be interesting to see to take a stab at re-editing those together and to see if you could make it a little bit more information dense,
yeah,
still readable, much more tense and entertaining.
Yeah. No, I think I agree with that, especially on second viewing. I think it's going to be even more tedious. Because, you know, you've already got a clear handle on what's happening here, and seeing it play out three times might have been interesting the first viewing, but the second viewing, no.
Or there could be a lot of things that we missed out on that we'd be like, maybe. Oh, man, this is crazy.
The other bit of style that I really liked is when, you know, he's going up and he's talking to Chris Tucker and he's getting him to come down to the car, and they go past the pool. And Tarantino lowers the camera down to fence level and shoots through the fence and tracks along with them, similar to how he does at the beginning mm-hmm. of the movie with Pam Grier. But he tracks along with them, and it makes it look like it's an old-time projector.
Mm.
And that's something. So Tarantino is, you know, a cinemaphile, and he's an audiophile, mm-hmm. I guess. He has a deep love for music and the technologies.
I don't think he's ever touched children.
Is that what that means? Boy, I mixed my terms up. Sorry. Yeah, so that comes across in this movie, because Robert De Niro at some point asks, I think it's asks Melanie about, like, CDs when she goes to put on.
Oh, no, it's Max Cherry when.
Oh, right. Ask Pam Grier about CDs when she puts on the records.
Which, by the way, Whoever thought vinyl would make a resurgence?
Yeah.
That's the craziest thing. And I'm not even that against it. Like, my friend Josh is like, kind of talked me into it. Like, it's more respectable than I thought it was, like, 2 years ago.
For sure.
But yeah. Still. Mm-hmm. But still.
But, yeah, I mean, clearly Max is this guy who I don't think is in touch with audio at all. No. He doesn't know who the Delphonics are.
Right.
I'm trying to see what Tarantino is talking about in regards to, like, the newest tech at that time, which would have been CDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to say these things are ridiculous. They don't sound nearly as good as this vinyl.
Right.
Listen to this vinyl. But then again, you're getting this on a digital audio system through a 11.1 speaker system in a theater.
And what I really enjoyed about it is after he said, oh, you don't do the CD thing, and she's like, I never got into it. What does he do? He goes and buys a fucking cassette tape.
Yeah.
Which is probably the shittiest audio format ever.
Yeah. And they play it in beautiful clarity in the soundtrack, which is totally untrue to a tape.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm... Yeah. Yeah. Like real... Like, say what you will about, like, reel-to-reel and 8-track,
mm-hmm.
but they were completely superior forms of a recording format over just fucking tape. That shit was I'd love to go back and listen to one.
Oh, it's bad.
What if I have any... Because I think I threw away my last tape, like, 10 years ago.
I don't have a player. Like, you can get a player.
I've got a player. I got a tape player at home. I just don't have any tapes. But I would like to go back and see some of the ones, because I had a whole bunch. I had an impressive tape collection.
I think my car might have one.
What's really bad is, like, back in high school, I used to deck to deck or high speed dubbed. Like, I bet some of those high speed dubbed copies I had were just like primo
vintage.
Listening experiences.
Just call them vintage.
Oh, yeah.
Then. Open up a store selling cassette tapes, vintage cassette tapes.
And what's really great is, like, when you're trying to eke out that last few milliamps from a battery, and it starts, like, you start noticing, like, oh, this is about 3% too slow. And it's like, how long can you stay with it? 10%, 20%.
Yeah, Delphonics not sounded so good at 20% speed.
But then there's this sweet spot where it starts to sound like an emo remix of it.
Right. While we're on the subject of music, I do not believe that Johnny Cash in any world has an uncle named Fudd. I think he just needed to rhyme with Tennessee Stud.
Do you think that he was a boy named Sue?
I believe that sooner than I believe that he has an uncle named Fudd.
I don't know. He likes to do, hey, my name's Sue. How do you do?
Uh-huh.
And then after he does that, he set himself up for a great internal rhyme, but then he says, now you got to die.
Yeah.
Like, what? Just leave me hanging there?
Yeah, subvert your expectations.
If you're Johnny Cash, you can get away with that shit.
For sure.
If you're Johnny Cash and you're playing a live album in front of a bunch of hardened criminals, you can do whatever the fuck you want. As long as you walk out of that place alive.
Yep. I also thought it was funny when they're in the courtroom scene and they're setting the bond for Pam Grier for Jackie at 10,000, and they say due to the fact that she's a risk of flight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, yeah,
she's literally a
stewardess. Attendant. Yeah,
that's funny because, like, it's the Tasha Yar asked for
25, yeah,
and they got, and the judge is like, you know what, fuck you, 10. Like, that never happens, does it?
Well, he said that it was, like, excessive, but I mean, with what she was charged with, it didn't sound like
I didn't think so, especially given the fact that she's but of course, yeah, given the fact that she's a stewardess. But, that's the thing is, like, I don't because the ATF guys were there, and they could have been like, hey, also, she works for this criminal who just spent 10 grand to bail this other dude out that we had under surveillance. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know. I also thought it was funny that, wait, did he put up 10? He only put up 1,000. He only put up 1,000, but he went to go Chris Tucker, and he claimed the full, like, I just spent $10,000 in your ass. There's a guy who doesn't know the difference between bail and bond.
Right. I mean, he used the $10,000 as collateral, but he paid the $1,000 fee.
So I thought the way it's like you pay the bondsman $1,000, and then, like, if you don't show up to court, they take it out of your ass. Like, that's how bounty hunters work.
I don't know. So that 10 grand that, you know, he uses throughout the movie, he started with on Chris Tucker's thing.
But it's only $1,000, I'm saying. But wait.
No, but it was 10.
It was 10?
It was 10, yeah. So he used that as collateral, because the guy's got to take collateral, I guess. And the 1,000 was his fee.
Ah, okay.
Like he takes 10% of the bond.
Wow, so as payment. Just busted that 10,000 there. Yeah, you're right, because at the end he was trying to give him back his 10,000.
Right.
Okay. All right. Again, I've only seen this movie once.
What was with turning the lights off in this movie? Because it happens all the time. And it kind of bookends, you know, the relationship with Jackie Brown and Ordell.
That's something that, like, Elmore Leonard seems to like to play with. The idea of criminals doing something that they think is menacing, but the protagonist is just like, get the fuck out of here. Like, like James Gandolfini's character in Get Shorty. Have you seen Get Shorty?
I haven't.
It's super good. But, you know, James Gandolfini's this big hulking dude, and he wasn't quite Tony Soprano fat ass mode back then. And this small-time crook is trying to intimidate John Travolta, who plays this, like, East Coast mafia guy, Shylock.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he's, like, you know, hulking over him, but he's, like, standing a couple steps or two on a staircase. And as he's saying his cold-blooded smack, John Travolta just straight punches him right in his dick. And then grabs him by and throws him down the staircase. Wow. And then looks at the mob guy, and he looks at the criminals like, what? You were trying to intimidate? So I feel like that's kind of like they're playing with the idea that Jackie, like, he's trying to intimidate Jackie Brown, and she's just not having any of it.
Yeah.
And he's just embarrassing himself.
Yeah, and then she plays that card at the end, you
right
know, against him,
right?
And
I think also,
and hers served a purpose, right? She turned the lights off so that the guys couldn't see that he didn't actually have a gun drawn.
Have a gun.
He has a gun on him.
I think he had the gun drawn too, but
oh,
I think you're
so?
Supposed to. I think. Okay. I think what you're supposed to wonder and what Max is wondering is, did she know it?
Yeah,
because it's pitch black. Like, was she just trying to pull the like suicide? I guess it would be homicide by cop.
Right.
Or was she really afraid for his life? And that's the thing that, like, Max was trying to figure out.
Yeah, it's another element of luck that saves her. You know?
Yeah, but again, that's just my what I was feeling in the scene. There might be a little bit more to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other lights on, lights off moments?
No, I think it's just those two scenes.
Yeah.
I can say one good thing for Ordell. He gets a new pair of gloves for every kill. The problem with this is, and I think you should take a lesson from OJ here, is, especially considering how much OJ he drinks, wear some common-ass gloves when you're committing murder. Don't wear the fucking $600 isotoners.
Right.
Don't wear these fucking leather-studded, braided bullshit. They're going to know.
Yeah.
Immediately, who did this?
Yeah, there was only 150 of these sold.
Right.
Three in the United States.
Yeah.
And you don't got OJ money to get
one
off,
to a
so.
Man in a yellow jacket with a ponytail and a soul patch to his waist.
Who's an international gun runner. Right. Yeah, no, yeah, that was hilarious. And the fact that, I mean, I thought that was pretty funny. Because I was, at the time, I'm like, how fucking obvious can you get? You come into this woman's apartment with gloves on,
right?
And you're shutting the lights off all the time. And I'm like, at first, I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then she pulls the gun, which I instantly realized she pulled for Max's car.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, I suddenly got a lot more clever.
It did.
And I don't know. Like, that's the thing. It's like that's an Elmore Leonard thing. The criminals are smart, but not like superhumanly smart. They're not like fucking Joker from The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, you know, and I think that's even kind of lampshaded in Melanie's conversation. Like, Melanie is smart enough to see, like, Odell's relative position in the universe, but it's not smart enough to realize that that doesn't make her a genius. You know, just the fact that she can spot the fact that he's not the world a super genius criminal doesn't mean that she's smarter than him.
Sure, yeah.
Because she can't even read the temperature of a Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Spoiler, it's always hot. It's always too hot to touch.
It is, yeah.
You don't ever want to fuck with Robert De Niro.
Even when he's had 9 rips off a bong.
That's right.
6 beers.
That's right.
And a screwdriver.
He hasn't touched marijuana since he got back from prison, and he can do 10 bong rips in a row, and he's still not mellow enough for you to fuck with.
Yeah, totally.
Not blaming the woman for violence against her. I'm just saying.
The other just hilarious thing to me in this movie is when Sam Jackson lets his hair down. He takes it out of the ponytail.
Yeah.
It's somehow worse than the ponytail.
Yeah. I mean, it's like he's not bald, but it seems like he should be.
Right. Yeah. Like, the hair is too thin to actually cover the head, like, even though...
I've never seen a skull cap made out of human hair,
yeah.
But somehow Sam Jackson is wearing it.
And then it just flows gloriously down to his mid-back. It's...
Yeah.
Oh, it's bad.
It's something else. It's something else.
Sure is. Let me ask you this. If you had the chance to walk away with $500,000, would you take it?
I've always said that I can be trusted with, like, up to $1 million duffled up.
Okay.
That's because right. $500,000 in today, I don't know that I can be set. I can't just take off the Belize and that's all they wrote. $1 million? Don't ever duffle up $1 million and turn your back around me.
What if it's...
Because I fancy myself fairly intelligent and the wheels might start spinning.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing.
And I'll be on the wrong end of a Michael Keaton drawn gun, I'm sure. But that's where the wheels would start spinning.
Yeah, I wonder if you can get out and just get away with it. Like, can she go spin this 450 now? Or are the cops going to, you know, keep an eye on her for a while? They she don't trust her.
Like, that. This thing is like, it depends what kind of cop you got. Mm-hmm. You know, are you got like a Dean Norris, Hank Schrader cop? Or do you got like, hey, I'm an ATF /DEA, and I just want to get my bust, and I want to get my promotion, and I want to go on in my life. Like, am I Michael Keaton? Am I going to fucking go to Spain and keep eyes on her and get into an Interpol bolo? Like, probably not.
So you think she closed the book on this one well enough?
I feel like that.
I do too.
Plus, the other thing is, like, everyone wanted to like her in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, even Odell, like, after, like, you know, she lowered the boom on him, she got instant credibility and respect. So everyone she met, except for Melanie, wanted to like her and kind of was rooting for her to succeed against all odds. So, like, I think that feeds into, I think Michael Keaton's more inclined to not, because he just, you know, like, hey, I'm glad you navigated this. He didn't get killed.
And they got what they wanted.
They got what they wanted, exactly. You
know, she wasn't the target, Ordell was. So.
Right.
I have one other question. So it's implied here that Lewis knows Max Cherry somehow. Do you think
he went to the office with Sam in the first scene? He went to the office with Odell to bail out Chris Tucker.
Oh, fuck, you're right.
That's
why. He's standing in the back, and he says, you okay out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, fine. Okay. Yeah. Okay, totally.
And
makes sense.
I think if you saw Robert Forrester once, you would remember him.
And yeah, if I saw him again in the mall, I'd be like, nope, this is gone south.
Not only that, but why did Max, like, acknowledge him?
Yeah. Max shouldn't even have been in the place.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's seen this movie only once. I don't want to say that's a huge plot hole because it could be that Jackie Brown was telling three different versions of the same truth, one to the police, one to Max, one to, you know, Odell and his associates. So it could be that Max thought that this was all part of the plan, so he was just kind of giving a friendly wave, but
maybe
that seemed sloppy.
Man,
it seemed really sloppy.
Like, if I'm Max, I'm going into the fitting room and I'm planting a walkie there or something.
Yeah.
I'm sitting out in my fucking car until Pam Grier calls me and says, okay, it's on, go.
Yeah, and if I'm Lewis, I definitely, when I see this guy... But the only thing is everyone had a little bit of the information. Like, if Odell had seen this, he would... Because he was already like, what the fuck with him being chummy at the mall before?
Yeah.
But Lewis didn't see that, and Odell did not tell him any of those misgivings, so he might have just thought... that's what he said, is like, hey, you know... Because they do also set up the fact that that's something that... Max does. He goes to the mall and watches a movie during the day every once in a while. So, like, 99 times out of 10, or 99 times out of 100, he'd be right about, like, he's just there with his wife or his girlfriend or seeing a movie or something.
Yeah.
Just that one time, he was working with Jackie Brown.
That's true. All right.
Should we read a little bit more feedback and then say peace to this movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Spencer H., this I'm only reading this because it's kind of entertaining. Said the hey Aaron, the only reason I bought these shares is because I lost a bet with Drew from Indianapolis on the forums regarding Game of Thrones.
Okay,
they had a bet where if something I don't want to spoil anything. If something happened to Game of Thrones, that he would buy commissions for Drew, and if he won, then Drew is going to have to get the last two commissions or last two shares of There Will Be Blood. And we've done both of these movies now, so everyone won.
We have.
He says the double D's really fucked me over in that one, talking about the Game of Thrones showrunners. I will say, as a man who has been known to dabble in marijuana, I've always appreciated the scenes with De Niro and Bridget Fonda smoking on the couch. A lot of movies make smoking cartoonish or call a lot of attention to it, whereas in this movie, it feels completely natural and understated. It's just another great example of Tarantino's talent with dialogue. Yeah, I agree. I always think it's funny when they show a dude like smoking weed, and then like it's like they dropped a tab of acid. Like De Niro's just being kind of like stone stupid and having trouble following the play. That's much more of an accurate depiction of what it's like.
Yeah, for sure.
Keith A, the opening song is Across 110th Street by Bobby Womack from the blaxploitation film of the same name, and it has been used quite often, most notably and most recently in a film with a montage in Ridley Scott's American Gangster featuring Denzel Washington. So that was cool. I did not know that. It's a really, because I haven't seen American Gangster yet. It's a really smooth, good montage scene. It's great for watching Pam Grier glide through an airport. Oh, did you know that was a graduate homage?
So I heard on the Direct podcast, I think. At some point, Eric and Levi talked about it. Yeah. I think they referenced the beginning scene of this movie in another movie's commentary.
Right.
That I was curious about, but I hadn't seen this movie, so I didn't want to go listen to it.
It's interesting because it's like thematically and emotionally completely different in its usage, but which is kind of a cool thing for Quentin Tarantino to play with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. That's all the feedback we had submitted by all of our commissioners. Once again, thanks to Steven Sprague, Spencer H., Libby Ross, Dr. Edible, Cellmouse, Brooks Ritt. Do you think Dr. Edible knows what it's like to smoke weed?
Oh, for sure.
I think he does, too.
Well, maybe smoke it? I'm not sure.
He
probably knows what it's like to feel high.
Okay, that's true.
But I don't know if he could spot fake smokers.
That's true. He's all about his PhD's in edible.
Yeah.
Edibology. Also could be a she. Could be a she.
Could be Dr. Edible.
I shouldn't gender presume.
Yep.
Brooks Riddle, Betamerick, Coco2MC. Prolific. Prolific. This Coco2MC prolific commissioner never submitted feedback. I don't think. Okay. Pretty sure. No brains, all sadness. Hope you can find some brains and happiness there. Martin Carlston, Eric Brown, RJ Joan 2, and Keith A. Thank you once again for making this movie happen. This is one of my favorite parts of the Commission podcast when I get an excuse to watch a film, a highly regarded film that I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Thanks again, and we will be back for, I don't know what the next one is. Do you?
I don't.
Our checklist says, oh God, Twin Peaks. I'm intimidated
by
this one.
I
mean, you got a problem with Lynch.
And this is the worst possible combination in my mind.
This is like when God revealed his glory to Moses. It's like we're only going to get to see a tenth of what makes this highly regarded, and it's a mystery.
The tip of Twin Peaks.
It's timely because the remake is about to come out.
Right.
So it might be an interesting springboard into discussion of that if we're able to... whatever, but we got that coming to us, and then The Fugitive, 1993.
There
That's
we go.
One of the first movies I saw that like was an adult movie.
Okay,
you know, like a series. Like, I mean, it's kind of weird because it's pretty straightforward, like thriller.
But it has like adult drama in it, right?
Yeah.
Like the guy's wife is killed.
And it's funny because the only reason I went to see it is because it's I love Han Solo and Indiana Jones,
right?
And then I think that's how it's like, oh my God, this has actually got plots and acting, and
yeah.
So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing that because I haven't seen that in probably 15, 20 years, man. So
yeah,
that'll
it's
be
been
a good
long
one.
Time.
All right, so that's the upcoming commission slate. We'll see you back real soon for those.